Welcome back. It's a Monday, the third day of December, 2018. I'm your host, Mark Hall, and yes, it's a very busy Monday indeed. There's lots of big news, lots of funny news, both the ha-ha and you-really-wouldn't-believe-it kind, lots of economic and financial news, and of course, lots of criminal news. But somehow, folks, your host can't help but think that the news that tells the real story are not only being overlooked by the fake news waste stream, we're used to that, but might even be seen as unimportant in the bigger scheme of things by the rest of us. And that'd be a mistake. So let's start there. And this one actually comes from the British Daily Mail, even though I suspect they don't have a clue about why it's important. Female Harvard student, says their headline, age 24, is ordered to move out of her apartment after her roommate searched her room. Hey, they don't need no stinking warrant. And found that she, I hope you're sitting down, legally owned guns. Yes, even in Massachusetts. And it's her MAGA hat that first made them suspicious. After her snowflake roommates complained that they felt uncomfortable because she actually had legal firearms, Layla Perney is now in a battle with her peers and her landlord, claiming she shouldn't have to bear additional expenses of being asked to move when she's fully within her rights to keep and bear arms. And you know what, folks? The story doesn't even mention it in here, but I think they would if it was an issue. There's nothing in her lease, evidently, that prohibits it either. And here's the part of the story that your host found really interesting. She told the Free Beacon, quote, "A few weeks ago, I came back to my apartment from a weekend trip and was confronted by one of my roommates who asked if I had guns in the house. After being told far too many lies to count, my roommates finally admitted that they'd searched my closet, under my bed, and in all of my drawers in pursuit of finding my guns. When I asked them why they were in my room to begin with, they each came up with completely contradicting stories, none of which made any sense, but one comment struck me in particular. Quote, "We saw that you had a MAGA hat, and come on, you're from Alabama, so we just kind of assumed you had something." Unquote. I'll skip over some of the background here, folks, because it really doesn't make any difference, like why the student who knows her rights also knows why it matters, and how scared the snowflakes are of firearms. It's the upshot here in the letter from the landlord that ought to also raise eyebrows. Said Layla Perney, "My landlord's email, though carefully crafted, showed tremendous prejudice against my right to legally have firearms." And the Daily Mail, in quoting a bit of the letter she's referring to, noted that landlord Dave Lewis wrote, "Since it's clear that Layla wants to keep her firearms, it would be best for all parties if she finds another place to live." Unquote. And it's the fact that neither the landlord, nor the reporters, nor evidently most of Harvard, sees the real truth here that's important. And the obvious solution here is real simple. If you think about it, as opposed to emoting, whining, and screaming in terror, as snowflakes tend to do, let the ones who went looking for trouble leave if they don't like it. And if that means they break their lease as well as their word, well, then guess who needs to be compensated for their breach? Now for the question. Does anybody listening really think there's going to be an attack of logic like that in the progressive bastion of Boston? And I guess at this point, folks, I'll suggest that as we go through the rest of the news today, you'll see how that's a lot more fundamental than might be obvious at first glance. Like this story that the Daily Caller and Gateway Pundit pay attention to, but not so much the three-letter Ministries of Truth. No less than 16 agents of the federal blockers of investigation raided the home of a whistleblower. And it actually happened on the morning of November 19th and took this long even for the alternative press to ferret it out. The problem was that when Dennis Nathan Cain had given a whole bunch of documents about the crooked Clinton Foundation and Uranium One scandal to Inspector General Michael Horowitz and both the Senate and House Intelligence Committees. Evidently, the real criminals here were concerned about what else the guy might have. And even though the protected whistleblower had actually given the documents to the proper investigative channels, according to his lawyer, these agents of one of the most corrupt three-letter agencies in the swamp spent over 6 hours going through the house with a fine-tooth comb in a raid that his lawyer correctly said showed, quote, outrageous disregard of whistleblower protections, and some have suggested was intended to send a clear message. Those documents that the FBI was so hot to seize revealed, I hope you're sitting down, that then FBI Director Robert Mueller, you know, the witch hunter in chief, had failed to investigate criminal misconduct concerning Uranium One and the real Russia company involved in that conspiracy, Rosatom. Said Kane's attorney, the Bureau raided my client to seize what he legally gave Congress about the Clinton Foundation and Uranium One. The Justice Department's Inspector General was informed the documents show that federal officials failed to investigate potential criminal activity, and it's obvious by now why, isn't it, regarding former Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton, the Clinton Foundation, and Rosatom, the Russian company that purchased Uranium One. And while we're talking about corrupt law enforcement and former heads of the FBI, here's one more quick story that probably won't shock you unless you think that the criminally negligent network is real news. Chief witch hunter and dirty cop Robert Mueller lied to the court, says Jim Hoft at the Gateway Pundit. By withholding exculpatory evidence from the court that would have tended to exonerate the duly elected president he seeks to unseat. It all has to do with the strong-arming of former Trump personal lawyer Michael Cohen. And the plea deal, evidently designed to get him to roll over and say something, anything, that they can use against the president. And here the Gateway Pundit quotes a story from Real Clear Investigations saying, contrary to waste-stream media speculation that Robert Mueller is closing in on the president, the special prosecutor's deal with lawyer Cohen offers further evidence that the Trump campaign did not in fact collude with the dreaded Ruskies during the 2016 election, according to congressional investigators and former prosecutors. The 9-page charging document filed with the plea deal suggests that the special counsel is using the Moscow Tower talks where the Trump Organization considered but ended up not building a Trump Tower in Moscow. Yeah, there's a crime for you. This is how they're trying to connect Trump to Russia, and the claim is that Cohen lied because the Moscow project continued 5 months longer in 2016 than he'd originally claimed to the ever-so-truthful Federal Bureau of Instigation. But congressional investigators with House and Senate committees leading inquiries on the Russia question told Real Clear Investigations that it looks like Mueller withheld from the court details that would exonerate the president. And that's considered a no-no if somebody not as well connected in the swamp as Mueller tries it. But under Mueller's and Comey's FBIs, that became SOP, don't you know? Here's the smoking disk drive on this one. On page 7 of the criminal information statement filed against Cohen, which is separate from but related to the plea agreement, Mueller mentions that Cohen tried to email Russian President Vladimir Putin's office twice, on January 14th and again on January 16th of 2016. But Mueller, who personally signed the document, does that really matter, omitted the fact that Cohen did not have any direct points of contact at the Kremlin and had resorted to sending the emails to a general press mailbox. What? Vladimir doesn't have a secret server like Hillary? Sources who've seen the additional emails point out that all of this omitted information undercuts the idea that there was a back channel and thus the special counsel's collusion case. Which, of course, explains why neither the press nor the American people nor especially the court needs to be bothered with information like that. Really, folks, after a while, it all kind of makes you wonder, why doesn't Mueller just get on with it, criminally charge the president, declare him guilty, and on his own authority have him removed from office? Because we don't need any indictments, we sure don't need any courts, and we obviously don't need any evidence either. Hey, you know what, folks? I'm going to throw one more story into the mix here. Color me somewhat suspicious on a Monday morning. The 3-star admiral in charge of the 5th Fleet in the Middle East is suspiciously dead. Vice Admiral Scott Starney, age 58, was found dead in his home in Bahrain on Saturday. The Daily Mail says the 20,000 sailors under his command were rattled by the news. And even though the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, yeah, you've probably heard of NCIS by now, is investigating, authorities claim that no foul play is suspected.
That's my story. Oh, that's my story. My story, and I'm sticking to it.
And yeah, folks, honestly, who knows? Yeah, it does smell a bit like Arkanside, but if there is something more going on here, at least you have to admit they weren't quite as inept as Mohammed bin Salman in the Khashoggi incident, or even the Brits with their Skripal and Novichok mess. Oh, and while I'm thinking about it, no doubt you've heard by now, George Herbert Walker Bush died over the weekend at age 94. In contrast to the fawning New World Order-loving waste stream, all I'll add is, As my wonderful grandmother used to say, may she rest in peace. If you can't say something nice about somebody, don't say anything at all. After all of that, I guess we do need a bit of good news, even if for nothing other than comic relief. Actually got a couple of them. Let's start here. There's more news about the crooked and incompetent Brenda Snipes in Broward County, Florida. After being finally suspended by Florida Governor Rick Scott from her position after she resigned, the most crooked elections commissioner in the United States. Well, probably not, folks, but she's certainly the most incompetent because she couldn't get away with it like the rest of them. Well, anyway, her shameless attorney announced over the weekend that she has now rescinded her resignation, saying the governor intends to embarrass her and, quote, tarnish her record, unquote. Do I need to say anything on that score? The shameless, oath-breaking criminals now say they're going to, quote, fight this to the very end. And I kind of wonder, is she going to manufacture a few million signatures on a petition supporting her effort? For criminal incompetence, you're fired. No, I unresign. Oh, and by the way, in case you haven't heard, unless Florida comes to its senses, this most corrupt public official is scheduled to draw a pension starting in January of 130,000 fiat bucks a year. I guess there is a certain poetic irony in that. The woman who prints fiat votes is getting paid with lots and lots of printed fiat currency. On into the criminal mob boss duo that the likes of Brenda Snipes were so anxious to have as dictator. Bill and Hill are scheduled to speak in Houston on Tuesday night, writes Jim Hoff. Gee, they can hardly wait. But tickets to Bill and Hillary's live show have sunk even lower now, $6, than the price of a Big Mac meal. And are you ready for the real irony? The Big Mac is probably healthier for you. At the very least, folks, it wouldn't be quite as hard to swallow. Which brings me next to the piece that's getting more attention, because it comes from the far-left progressive commentator for the New York Times, Maureen Dowd. Maybe she's upset because she paid $177 to hear the communist superstars speak, whereas if she'd waited till the day of event, she could have gotten in for less than $10. I'm feeling something foreign, wrote the renowned leftist, something I've never felt before. It takes me a moment to identify it. I'm feeling sorry for the Clintons. In the 27 years I've covered Bill and Hillary, I've experienced a range of emotions, she said. They've dazzled me and they've disgusted me, but now they're mystifying me. I can't help but think she's probably mystified a lot. She then goes on to talk about Scotiabank Arena, the home of the Toronto Maple Leafs, and it's a depressing sight. Two for the price of one in half the arena. The hockey rink is cordoned off, so forth and so on. And you've heard this part of the story. I even get reassigned to another section, she writes, as the Clintons' audience space shrinks. And then she begins to make some admissions. I can't fathom, she says, why the Clintons would make like aging rock stars and go on a tour of Canada and the U.S. at a moment when the Democrats are hoping to break the stranglehold of their cloistered, superannuated leadership, sick, and exult in a mosaic of exciting new faces. All right, enough of that. What's the point, though, she says? It's not inspirational, it's not for charity, and that's for sure, folks, if you follow the Clinton charities over the years. They're not raising awareness about a cause. And I think this is a typo. Yeah, it's like Al Gore with global warming. It's a joke. They're only raising awareness, she says, about the Clintons. And here's the money quote. The Clintons, she says, refuse to be discarded. It's been their joint project for half a century to be at the center of the public scene and debate. She doesn't say it, I will, to be joint dictators. But the way that the whole thing came crashing down, she says, in 2016, it's just too hard for them to bear. They'd like to rewrite the ending, but there's no way to do that, unquote. And when even the worst sycophant cheerleaders, folks, are saying you've overstayed your welcome, and they're even embarrassed that you're evil being so fully exposed, I guess you could say, to paraphrase Yogi Berra, the fat lady is singing. One more bit of whimsical news out of the District of Criminals swamp. At least this one, too, is revelatory. It comes from Reason.com about a D.C. agency that's now sorry, they say, that their staff was so ignorant of simple geography and American history that they should be working for communist Congress critter Ocasio-Cortez. Earlier this month, says the story, Gavin and Marina Clarkson were trying to apply for a marriage license in the District of Criminals where Marina lives. But they ran into trouble when a number of employees didn't even know that New Mexico is actually a state, not a foreign country. And it wasn't just one ignoramus in the office. It was evidently a whole bunch of them. Gavin posted to Facebook that he gave them his New Mexico driver's license, and then they came back and say, quote, "My supervisor says we cannot accept international driver's licenses. Do you have a New Mexico passport?" And are you ready for this, folks? Quote, "They went back to the supervisor to check if New Mexico was a state. Twice." At least, he said, all the couples waiting behind us in line thought it was funny. And just maybe, by now, folks, all of us are starting to have a better understanding of what has happened to the rule of law in the formerly free republics. We've got more news that might be good news. I guess we'll have to wait and see, although the markets, at least for now, are still using any excuse to buy the dips. "It's a truce," said the stories that came out on Sunday about the most anticipated dinner between the U.S. and Chinese presidents in years, down there at the G20 summit in Buenos Aires. Trump and Xi have agreed no new tariffs after January 1. So for now, at least, the trade war isn't escalating. They're going to keep tariffs at 10% for 90 days, and we'll see what happens in the interim. The White House said afterwards that Trump and Xi had a highly successful meeting, and that President Trump had agreed to leave tariffs on products imported into the U.S. at 10% after January 1, while China agreed to buy a substantial amount of products from the United States. Quote, "Very substantial U.S. agricultural, energy, industrial, and other products immediately from the U.S. to reduce the trade imbalance. Still, though, the truce is only temporary. If, after 90 days, a further trade pact is not reached between the U.S. and China, tariffs will rise to 25% after all." One of Trump's goals for the Xi dinner was to get China to do more to halt the flow of synthetic opioids like fentanyl into the U.S., and Xi did agree to that, designating fentanyl as a controlled substance, quote, "meaning that people selling fentanyl in the United States will be subject to China's maximum penalty under the law," which they hope, said Sarah Huckabee Sanders, might help reduce opioid deaths. There was a bit more on the agenda, too, like the Qualcomm NXP deal, more bilateral visits and more open markets between the two nations, and even some tweets on Monday morning by the president saying that he, President Xi, and President Putin will start talks on ending the uncontrollable arms race sometime soon. All of which, as I've already mentioned, led to some euphoria on Wall Street. Here's one headline: world stocks, U.S. futures, and crude oil all soar as Trump and Xi deliver on the early Christmas rally. In China, the Shanghai Composite soared 2.9% after the announcement of the agreement. U.S. stock markets were a bit giddy, too. NASDAQ was up 100 points, Dow Jones over 250 points as of mid-morning, and so forth. Even paper precious metals were allowed a bit of a bounce. Carmaker shares, too, surged after Trump mysteriously tweets after the meeting that China will reverse auto tariffs, leading to their best session in years. But as Zero Hedge points out, there were some Scrooges in the Christmas rally. One of their headlines said, "Difficult to trust why the truce trade-triggered sugar rush will end in a hangover." Even the infamous vampire squid, bankster Goldman Sachs, poured cold water on the latest trade deal truce, saying, quote, "The odds of a comprehensive deal, once these 3 months are up, is only 20%. Oh, and on a related but slightly different front, one more interesting bit of news out of the G20. They agreed on a joint communique from the attendees, which, quote, "caters widely to Trump and doesn't even mention protectionism," which is one of those words that was considered a key sticking point for the U.S. delegation. They also didn't waste too much ink on the bogus issue of man-made global climate change, either. The other international news over the weekend seemed to center on the latest riots in Paris. For more than 2 weeks, as a Bloomberg story, that country has been disrupted by an unusual protest. I won't try to butcher the French, but in English it's called the Yellow Vests. France, of course, is used to labor unrest and communists that get out of line, with strikes being something of a national pastime. But, says Bloomberg, even this time it's different, because there's something like 100,000 people blocking toll roads, petrol stations, and crossroads. It's creating major disruptions to transport and retail, also proving to be extremely tricky to defuse, because there's no single protest leader to negotiate with. And perhaps even a bigger concern, it may be a real threat to the country's retailers. The protest started all the way back on November 10th with thousands of demonstrators demanding lower gasoline prices and taxes. 2 weeks later, demonstrators marched on the Champs-Élysées, triggering social unrest, and surprisingly, the protest is benefiting from significant backing, with fully 84% of the French public calling it justified, according to a poll for Le Figaro. Perhaps even more concerning, video has emerged, thanks to folks like Paul Joseph Watson, showing French police removing their helmets in solidarity with the Yellow Vest protesters. And further rioting over the weekend shows the movement is now spinning out of control. Protesters, who of course aren't allowed to have guns themselves, managed to steal a real assault rifle from cops, attacked police, burned cars, and left 133 injured, says the Daily Mail headline, in France's worst riots in over half a century. Not-so-popular socialist French President Macron, who faced calls to resign from protesters that scrawled anti-Macron slogans on the Arc de Triomphe, vowed to bring rioters to justice as he inspected the wreckage on the Champs-Élysées, where he was jeered by lingering yellow vest-wearing supporters before chairing a crisis meeting with his ministers amid calls to declare a state of emergency or even send in the army to quell the violence. There are, of course, some suggestions that it might be far more effective for him to just listen and step down. Here's what the waste stream isn't spending much ink on, but the politically correct, like Paul Joseph Watson, are pointing out. There may be anger at Macron's gas hikes to fight non-existent global warming that kick-started the demonstrations, but the protests seem to be part of a wider revolt against the French and EU elite and have taken on somewhat of a nationalist tone. Prominent leaders of the protest movement have outlined their support for failed asylum seekers to be returned, imagine that, to their home countries, and for legal immigrants to undergo rigorous integration programs, and for France to introduce popular referendums as part of the country's constitution. As political commentator Kark Sharrow explains, what's unfolding is, quote, an organic, leaderless protest movement with no clear ideology that combines elements from both the political left and right. Protesters, though, are unified in that they have completely lost faith with the establishment parties. RT was even a bit more blunt in their assessment, saying that the Yellow Vest protests are aimed at Macron's pro-EU administration and not just its fuel tax policy. The rage has to do with the incompetent, said one French political commentator to RT, and while protesters may vent their anger at President Emmanuel Macron, quote, they don't realize the problem is much deeper and has to do with the general policy of the European Union. Even more cops support Yellow Vest protesters than Macron, said one French police union chief to RT. And just maybe the situation in Italy sheds more light on the real problem. Here's a piece from The Express out of the UK. Italy has walked out of the UN migration meeting, saying correctly that national borders are no business of the UN. And they're upset about the so-called UN Global Compact for Migration, which intends to make any criticism of migration policy a criminal offense. Which, I guess, brings me to the stories we'll start to wrap things up with today. This one comes from an individual on Border Detail, who blogs under the nom de plume of Murphy's Law, and wrote over the weekend about the continuing migrant invasion inland from Tijuana. Yesterday, he said, our operations were disrupted when 5 buses stopped on Mexican Highway 2 just on the other side of the border fence, and 217 Guatemalans got off, walked over our fence and onto our country, and then sat down to await border patrol. They do this regularly now, and this bunch admitted coming from Tijuana where they'd arrived with the caravans. They didn't seem to know, or wouldn't say, who chartered their buses, but what they do know is that they now claim asylum. And then they get a court date, and they're released into the U.S. until the hearing, and of course they never show up, and we'll have to hunt them down and try to deport them later, one by one. This screwed us up, says Murphy's Law, because it took every single border agent in the sector to process them, meaning no one was watching any of the rest of the fence or the interior checkpoint. And the cartels know this, and they exploit the opportunity to move whatever they want into our country. My small unit, he said, had an operation plan that needed support from Border Patrol, but we got hosed and had to improvise. And today, every time we tried to do anything near the border, more small groups of Hondurans and Guatemalans came across the fence and then waited, grinning, to be taken in. They've clearly been coached on the distractions, where to cross, and what to do when they get in. Trouble is, we can't do a thing to protect our borders now because we're all too busy ferrying these invaders around like some sort of large-scale welfare Uber. Evidently, folks, there are a lot of stupid politicians and election supervisors out front, but the real invasion and destruction effort is well planned and still on schedule. And may Yahuwah bless you and yours.